I'm Christopher Leiden. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. We call this an American conversation with global attitude. We're talking this hour with Professor Glenn Lowry, an economist at Brown. Glenn, I think of you as a polymath of black experience from the ivory tower, also from the street, and you're famous for making connections and also for changing your mind. I wanted to ask you in particular a question that lingers after the campaign flap around Barack Obama's Chicago pastor Jeremiah Wright. The Reverend went way over the top, out of bounds, it seemed, in some of his goddamn America rants, and Barack Obama disowned him. People wonder, will the issue return? I wonder, did we get the right or wrong impression of the black church? In my view, one of the best-kept secrets of American life, and right up there with baseball among the American treasures. What did we learn about the black church is what I want to know, and did it get anything like fair exposure here?
Well, I don't know. These are large questions. I don't know that we learned very much about the black church. I think we may have learned a great deal about the lack of knowledge about the black church, which characterizes our society, and about how easy it is for an institution with the rich and complex root and history to become caricatured and be some kind of placeholder or cipher or sort of virtual icon within the context of an American political conversation that hasn't got much at all to do with the black church. It strikes me that the characterization of Jeremiah Wright's sermons as rants is highly inaccurate. Even that so-called goddamn America transgression of his, placed in context, was an argument. I don't feel comfortable saying this because it has become politically unacceptable to say anything good about Jeremiah Wright. Now Jeremiah Wright is this this buffoon, is this extremist, is this threat to Barack Obama's aspirations, is this emblem of an angry and alienated black America. But I must say that the theological context out of which Wright's critiques come is not dishonorable, in my view, not un-American. It may not be wholly characteristic of black opinion, which is variegated, of course, but it is a strand of black nationalist critical thinking that, while it may not fit well with a presidential campaign, nevertheless deserves to have a place at the table of American conversation. So I don't think this really has very much to do with the black church. I think this has to do with presidential politics and with the conflicting tendencies of different constituencies within the American polity. I think it has to do with media. I think it has to do with the meanings of race, the complicated and often conflicting meanings of race within the larger American political culture. I think the black church well may have taken a hit to the extent that people come away saying, aha, this is what's going on in our black churches, or to the extent to which the profound spiritual witness of the African-American church and the ministries get reduced to these kinds of cartoon representations. But, you know, the black church survived a great deal. It will survive this without any doubt.
But it is that reality of the black church that I just wanted to sort of go back and unearth. You know the South Side of Chicago. You've had your encounters with Jeremiah Wright. Start with just your own sense of why you think Barack Obama joined that church and what you think he was getting out of it.
Well, I have no way of knowing, you know, Barack Obama has said some things in his writings about his own personal journey, developments in his life, and what led him to the church, led him to Christ, to a relationship with Jesus Christ. which was nurtured in that church. I'm not at all surprised to learn that a extremely intelligent and dedicated young man who might come somewhat as an outsider to the South Side of Chicago, a man of African descent who is trying to find his way and trying to get some moorings and some anchoring in his life, might have wandered into a church, first for the very utilitarian reasons of getting himself known in the community and making contacts with the people around. Who would I go to and talk to? Well, the minister is a place to start if I want to know the community, but might have found himself so moved and maybe even shaken in the recognition of the need for some spiritual grounding in his own life, and might have found the preaching and the teaching and the fellowship and the comfort of people in that church to be something much to his liking. Might have found himself making a home there, maybe finding a wife there, maybe finding God there. Might have just been swept away by the beauty and the richness and the pathos and the complexity of this cultural form in American life, and might have felt very much at home there, might have felt blacker than he ever felt before there. If I might have come to understand the rich possibilities of the Christian faith in ways that would never otherwise have occurred to him. I see nothing difficult to understand about how such a person might have come to be a member of such a congregation.
That's a whole lot to find in one place, from wife to God to music to fellowship to Jesus to a community. And that's no small stop on the way. Let me project a little bit. I joined a black church in Boston at very much the same time he joined Jeremiah Wright's church in Chicago. I'm a white guy, but I found a great many of those things, and they're formidable. You find a tremendous welcome, first of all. You found a tradition, a scriptural tradition of huge belief. You find also an activist tradition. One of the persistent admonitions from that pulpit of Michael E. Haynes was, God forbid we should be so heavenly minded that we're no earthly good. That marriage of faith and justice, but at the same time, even more powerfully, a community that has a social history, a cultural identity, but is also not tribal. It is not us against them. It is not a warring church. It is a church of reconciliation, church of worship, a Bible-believing church, an Orthodox church in that sense. It's extraordinary. You've had your own dramatic church experiences, and I hope you'll throw them in the pot.
Well, yeah, you know, it's not about me. But I will say this. I will say that I know what you're talking about. I hear you, my brother. I hear where you're coming from when you talk about the sort of greatness and the sort of humane, inspiring character of this great institution. And I want to say that you know, the African American church, the black church, is born in slavery. I mean, it's born in my denomination, African Methodist Episcopal. Is founded by people like Richard Allen in Philadelphia, you know, in the 1770s and the 1780s. Okay, this is going all the way back. So we're talking about free persons of color living in the north of the United States at the time of the Revolution. Okay. Now, you've got social segregation and you've got stigma and you've got the derogation of the African-American population to a caste, a lower caste status. And you have the institution of slavery that is still 67 years from being extirpated. And you have the need to inspire and uplift and comfort and impart hope to a population that is in this condition. And you have the witness of the gospel. You have the ministry of Jesus Christ as rendered through this institution, which comes into the lives of the people and becomes a constituent part of them. So we're talking about an institution that goes all the way back and that is, you know, joined at the hip with African-American history and culture, and is a principal means by which the black population of the United States managed not to be crushed in its soul by the weight that it has had to bear all of these years. So, you know, not enough good can be said about that as far as I'm concerned.
And let's not forget the Old Testament piece, too. Not only the story of slavery and delivery, but all those Psalms of David, which live in the black church as maybe nowhere else. I was glad when they said unto me, let us go into the house of the Lord. This is the day.
Stand within thy gates, O Jerusalem. Yeah, yes, this is the day the Lord has made. Let us rejoice and be glad in it. Exactly.
Amen.
Right.
Go on about your own experience, A, with the church, and also with Reverend Wright.
Well, Reverend Wright, so my story, and I'll just try to keep this very short, is that I was a Reaganite in the 1980s, yes? A black Reaganite. I was slated to become a high official in the Department of Education, the deputy of the department under William Bennett, who was secretary at the time in the second Reagan administration. And then my life hit the skids, scandal, public humiliation, drug problems, extramarital infidelity, all these things came out. Suddenly my high-flying political career was over, and I was left trying to grapple with, you know, the existential dilemmas of survival under the weight of such misfortune and such self-inflicted undoing. and in that condition, I turned, as many do, for hope and comfort and some structure. I turned to God, and I was very fortunate to have Pastor Ray Hammond, whom I had known from other work, not in the context of his religious ministry, come alongside and invite me and my family into a community which we joined with great enthusiasm, and which in the late 80s and early mid-90s really made all the difference to us. Our sons, Glenn and Nehemiah, were born into that church and into that community. And it was just a fundamental reorienting of my life, and as I say, a pillar that helped to support our family. In any case, in that time, I was going through some political changes, but I think I'd still have to have been considered a neoconservative, a critic of civil rights orthodoxy, right of center social analyst. And I went out to a seminary in Ohio at the invitation of the people who were running a doctoral program to come and give some lectures on social policy to a group of urban ministers studying under the tutelage of the legendary Samuel Proctor, who were getting doctoral degrees at this seminary, the Union Theological, I say Union, I meant to say United Theological Seminary in Dayton, Ohio.
I remember him, the Reverend Dr. Samuel G. Proctor. He was the Pope of black preachers at the time.
Indeed, legendary, revered senior figure toward the end of his career. And he had gathered together a group, I suppose they were in this class that I addressed, about 20, of very prominent and successful urban ministers, pastors, who were pursuing their doctoral studies in this innovative program. Jeremiah Wright was one of them. Charles Adams of Detroit was another. Johnny Ray Youngblood of Brooklyn was another. Frank Reed of Baltimore was another. I'm leaving some people out. My memory fails, but they were all distinguished, leading large thousands-plus member congregations in cities throughout the Northeast and Midwest. In any case, I had come there as this neoconservative African-American bad boy whose articles in places like the Public Interest and Commentary magazine and the New Republic had preceded me. And I gave my spiel, which was pretty much, Reagan's not right about everything, but he's right about a lot of things that are really important here. Let me tell you why. And they listened more or less patiently, and when we got to the Q&A, they lit into me, and Jeremiah Wright was at the head of the queue, lighting into me. I was some kind of sellout Uncle Tom type. I mean, they were polite. I don't know that I was called any names that I couldn't repeat here, but I mean, it was very uncomfortable. And the main point was, where was my prophetic voice? What was I doing? I got all the way to Harvard, and this is the best I could do? You know, the best I can do for my people is to parrot what the neocons are saying? This is the best I can do? I get brought low by life, and where do I turn? Okay, I turn back to my community. How do I integrate my intellectual gifts with my experience and with my identity and with my responsibilities? What's my program? Is it really just to get a gold star as the brightest kid in the class? Is it really just to get another headline in the, you know, in the Tony political magazine and have everybody talking about what I've said? Or do I have a deeper program? Do I have a more eternal program? All right, if I call myself saved and sanctified, how am I relating that to this other thing? People are saying, and what about your people who suffer? And this kind of thing. So there was a critique. As I say, Jeremiah Wright was right at the front of it. But the thing that I remember most keenly...
Was he angry with you for, in effect, crawling back to an easy refuge in the church after your comeuppance?
Well, no, I wouldn't say that, although I think he may have been, and now I'm just imputing perhaps, he may have been a little skeptical about what my motives were. But, you know, the church is the church, okay? So where else would I go? I mean, the kind of thing like that. And thank God the church is there. No, that wasn't it. I think he was angry with me about not seeing the connect between a community which I had, in effect, taken for granted and come to in my hour of need, on the one hand, and the other ministry that I had, the public ministry, that is to say, the ministry of writing to the nation, as an African-American intellectual sitting at Harvard and with access to all of the, you know, of the media and all of the capacity to have my thoughts projected before people, not having connected my my instinctive knowledge that I would be loved and nurtured and supported within the community, not having connected that to whatever my program might be for the public, that he saw a disconnect there in a sense of perhaps being irresponsible and not having a deeper political and spiritual vision. My political vision and my spiritual vision were in conflict with each other, I think, is how the critique might have gone. But the point that I want to make, or the thing that I just want to say, is that that critique was not the most important thing that happened there. No, the most important thing that happened there was a prayer. After all the critique had come in, and I'm sure I lost the argument with that audience, okay? I had said what I had to say. A few people might thought, oh, this is a very bright young man, and, we hope that he can be brought around to whatever, but he still needs a lot of saving on that, on the political front, I think they thought. I think
standing
they mostly would have
agreed. Prayer, as they would say, yeah.
In the need of prayer. But the point was, I was there. Okay?
It was
John Ray Youngblood who, in a prayer that was sort of meant to be, I think, the formal closing of the session. This was a 3-hour. I talked for an hour. They rejoined for 2 hours kind of situation. Okay. And believe me, they were rejoining with vigor. But at the end of it comes Johnny Ray Youngblood, the Brooklyn-based pastor, who makes as the focus of his prayer the observation that he's so glad that God knows where the ivory tower is. He's so glad that you don't ever get too high and too mighty to be reached by the word of God and to have one's life transformed by it. That he knew that God wasn't finished with me yet. He knew that whatever the arguments was that I was making at this point, the fact that I was a confessing believer and that I came there primarily as a Christian, and only secondarily as a neoconservative critic of conventional liberal social policy, that was the overriding fact. And so I'm in the tent now. God's working on me now. He's got faith that it's all going to work together for good. He's so glad that you don't get, with all your PhDs, with all your accolades, with all the lectures that you're giving in all these countries throughout the world, with everybody telling you that you're this or that you're that, you realize that you're not you know, you ain't saved yet. You know, there is a way. This is the way. This kind of thing like that. He prayed this really powerful and moving prayer. And it wasn't so much about forgiveness, but it was about hope. You know, it wasn't like he was saying, you have transgressed, but that's okay. Okay? I don't think Johnny Ray Youngblood agreed with what the politics that I was putting out there any more than Jeremiah Wright did. But what he was saying was, that's okay. Because, you know, it's about relationship. And, you know, you enter into that, everything is possible. So, you know.
He was probably addressing personal issues too, and maybe saying there's more joy in heaven for the lost sheep that's found than for the 99 that were never lost or something. This is a very familiar place for the black church, for Bill Clinton, for example. It's the first place for him to go and shrive his soul after Monica, and for many people to hope for a redemption. It's a stop on the way. But there are so many other gifts there, even the ones you just enumerated, that I wonder why it was so hard for the media to caricaturize, give just one or two YouTube clips that would inflame the world without seeing, you know, the rest of the story in that case. Or is that just, maybe that's the media, but I thought it was unfair to the church.
Yeah, I'm not going to argue with you about that. Of course it was unfair to the church. I mean, the church was made into a cartoon. Wright actually said something during one of his rants. He said, you know, reporters were going through the church bulletin and calling people who were the sick and shut-in, whose telephone numbers were listed in the bulletin that other members might call to give them comfort and support, calling them to get their opinions about, you know, whatever the controversial issue might be. And Wright was, I think, correctly outraged by this behavior, which, of course, if anyone has ever been the subject of a media feeding frenzy, you know this is just par for the course. They park out in front of your house. They go through your trash can and read your mail. They, you know, they call up your family members who are unsuspecting and, you know, then run the tape for the telephone conversation on the evening news or whatever it might be. This is just par for the course. But, you know, as I was saying earlier, I don't think this is really about the church. The church takes a hit reputationally to the extent that people are left with the impression that, you know, somehow it's a bizarre, weird place where a lot of stupid things are said and a lot of sort of hateful, you know, ideas are propounded. I don't believe that's true. Frankly, I don't believe that's true about the Trinity United Church of Christ under the leadership of Jeremiah Wright, for that matter. But certainly not true about the black church as a whole. But this wasn't about the church. This is about a presidential campaign. This is about a candidate who comes off of the south side of Chicago, which is an unknown world to most of the country. And this is about the sensationalism and about the need to reduce complex things like, is someone steeped in the political world of the south side of Chicago sufficiently compatible with mainstream American values that such a person could be elevated to the highest office in the land? Now, if I need to say so, let me just say I have no doubt in my own mind about that, but I could also allow for the possibility that many Americans might have real doubts in their minds about that. So I think Obama's running for president and coming out of this community, and this community being, because of Sunday being the most segregated hour in American society, you know, Sunday morning, and because of the walls of cultural segregation that exists in our society, where people really know very little about each other in intimate ways across the racial lines, because of that, this thing blows up. But I don't really think it's about the black church.
There was a reaction on television and in white America that we're shocked that anger is coming out of these YouTube excerpts of Jeremiah Wright in the pulpit. How does this body politic in an election year deal with the way he deals with inevitable anger in black America?
So it's quite all right for a prophet to be angry. I mean, you know. Best I recall, some of those books in the Old Testament, I mean, I'm talking about Amos, I'm talking about Obadiah, I'm talking about Jeremiah, but I mean, some of these prophetic voices coming out of the Old Testament certainly gave vent to fury and to outrage. you know, it's not right. But running for president of the United States on anger? Uh-uh. Running for president of the United States on outrage at the failure of one's own society? No way. That's not going to work. And this is not only for a black man. I mean, Bill Clinton, one of his famous lines from that 1992 campaign, as I recall it, is there's nothing wrong with America that can't be fixed by what's right with America, or something like that. In other words, let's acknowledge that there are problems, but let's not lose sight of the fact that we are America, right? City on a hill capable of fixing all of those problems. Barack Obama's bargain with the American people, if I can put it in those terms, the thing that's going on that I see, is that he's saying, yeah, I'm a black guy, you know, but I'm also a white guy. You know, yeah, I see that there's stuff that's wrong, but like Bill Clinton, I think that what's right with America can fix what's wrong if we can just get our heads together around it and we can point ourselves in the right direction. He can't be angry. Barack Obama cannot be angry and get this done that he's trying to get done. Jeremiah Wright is angry, right? Now, maybe he's got reason to be angry. And maybe that anger in the context of Barack Obama running for the state legislature or doing community organizing made all the sense in the world. But the story has changed for the candidate. And what might have been a source of inspiration or might have been, you know, critically regarded, but nevertheless something that needed to be considered in a debating society-like manner, now has no place whatsoever in the stage-managed self-presentation, which is a presidential candidacy.
Glenn, is there an ember there that can burst into flame in the fall campaign, or is it over?
Well, I'm not a political expert. I don't think it's over, though. I think the effort of the, let me call them pro-Obama forces, but I mean nothing partisan here, people who want to see that candidacy succeed, both in the press and outside of it, the effort to marginalize this topic and to make it into, oh, why are we talking about that? That's so boring, that's ridiculous, that's inappropriate. While that well may succeed within the context of a Democratic Party fight, I don't think it has a prayer of succeeding in the context of a larger national conversation. I think Barack Obama has the Reverend Jeremiah Wright tattooed to his left arm or tied around his neck or have whatever metaphor you want to use for the duration. I mean, he said very clearly, Obama has, that Wright doesn't speak for him, that he doesn't agree with some of the substantive political views that Wright expressed, nor maybe the way that they were expressed. But he has to grapple with the fact that, you know, he's a member of the church for over a decade and a half, that church is integrated into a political a political culture on the south side of Chicago that is different. Again, as Jeremiah Wright says, different doesn't mean deficient. That was one of his lines in his recent public addresses, Jeremiah Wright's lines, and certainly different on the south side of Chicago. I mean, after all, it is a fact that the congregation at Trinity United Church of Christ was on the whole very admiring of the Muslim ministry of the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan, the despised, reputedly anti-Semitic lightning rod figure. Farrakhan and Jeremiah Wright may not have worshipped in the same way or with the same theological conviction, but they certainly ministered to the same community of people out there on the south side of Chicago, and they certainly are products of the same historical dynamic of African-American self-assertion and nationalist and Afrocentric orientation. No, that's not characteristic of the black church as a whole, the Afrocentric nationalist orientation, I mean to say, but it is an element of the African-American experience that finds its reflection in the black church, in black liberation theology, in Afrocentric worship, which one finds even in the Catholic church being manifest. Some of these Afrocentric cultural tendencies, even in Catholic congregations, they have been manifest. You know, there is the south side of Chicago. And on the south side of Chicago, some of those views that Jeremiah Wright gave voice to, like, I don't put anything beyond my government. I think they're capable of anything. No one runs for president saying that their government is capable of anything. The government that I would lead is capable of anything. Nobody, except maybe Jesse Jackson, runs for president saying that. a lot of people on the south side of Chicago believe it, okay? A lot of people on the south side of Chicago They're not Zionist. I mean, again, with due respect, I don't mean any offense to anybody. I'm just here to report to you, okay, that they may find some sympathy with the Palestinians' struggle. They may see the Palestinians as niggers of the world in a certain metaphorical sense that they can relate to in their own experience. Now, that could be right. That could be wrong. It may not be what the American government wants its policy to be. It may not be in the best interest in the long term of American security. I'm not taking a position on that one way or the other. I'm, again, just here to report that the milieu, the political hothouse, the social and cultural reality that is 750,000 people in one of the largest ghetto, urban, racially exclusive enclaves on the planet, what they think out there, how they talk, how they see themselves, and how they see their government, and the critical distance that they see between themselves, and perhaps to some degree, the prophetic witness that they may feel that they and their community bring in assessing the actions of the American government. No, they're not going to all just salute the flag and sing the national anthem and march happily off behind the armies under the banners of freedom, wherever those armies may be going. Yes, they're going to recall that the native population of this continent was exterminated in the founding and expansion of the government. Yes, they're going to recognize that the very Constitution that we revere made a compromise with slavery, which lasted for almost a century, and that it took another century after that before the legal requirements of that Constitution actually came to be embraced and enforced in every state of the Union. How could those 750,000 African-American descendants sitting on the south side of Chicago not have that history vividly in their mind? And how could it not be reflected to some degree in the spiritual witness and the inspirational preaching that would come out of those churches? No, most of those churches, most of the African-American churches in Chicago or any place else are probably not as radically activist as Jeremiah Wright's ministry was, but they all, I think, share to some degree a connectedness with and a sympathy for the historical evolutions, for the context out of which that comes. They express it in different ways and to different degree. So, I mean, the thing that worries me, Chris, more than that the black church will be somehow denigrated and lose respect, because I don't think there's any keeping the black church down, okay? The thing that worries me more than that is that the root of some of this, I'm going to call it again, prophetic voice that comes out of the African-American church. America, you're not as good as you think you are. America, you're not so high up on that city on the hill that you've constructed for yourself that you cannot, go wrong. Let's have the capacity to criticize. You know, my fear is that that voice will be somehow rendered unacceptable, that the need for a presidential candidate to establish for the broad mainstream of the American people that he is not some kind of radical will somehow bring with it the conclusion that the critical context out of which that radical expression came was itself illegitimate, ridiculous, absurd, not worthy of being considered for another moment. Let's move quickly on to the next case. That's my concern.
So we all want to read the prophet Jeremiah, who is the model of this kind of denunciations of his people, his stiff-necked people, and God's not happy with them, etc. Are we also going to have to get our heads around us, meaning white America, what you refer to as black liberation theology? Is that going to be a hard meal to get down?
I guess. I mean, from just my reading the newspapers and so on, I get the impression that the quick commentary is black liberation theology. And then we remember the liberation theology of the left wing of the Catholic Church in Latin America and the 80s and all of that. And it's all a bunch of Marxist or quasi-Marxist muddled, don't get the Christianity right, don't get the social analysis right, kind of friendly to the communist kind of thing. And then therefore dismissed out of hand. I mean, who would want to have anything to do with that? That would be too bad. I mean, I should say, I don't think black liberation theology is a mainstream doctrine within African-American Christianity. I don't believe that that's the case. I'm sure that there are data on that that one could go to get an objective reading. But my sense of it is that that tends to be a little bit edgier and that the black church as an institution is pretty conservative and is pretty focused on the spiritual. Not that people are apolitical, but that the driving impetus is on, you know, how we're going to live our lives as Christians. On the other hand, what I want to say is, and again, let me quote Jeremiah Wright. I mean, he says the religion of the people who were on the deck of the slave ship, the God that they're praying to, and the he would have used the term hermeneutic, which translates into lens of interpretation that they bring to their experience, is different from the religion of the people who were down below in the lower decks of the slave ship and the God that they pray to and the framework or interpretive lens that they bring to experience. This seems to me to be a pretty commonsensical observation that if you're a people who have been you know, despised, denigrated, terrorized, stigmatized, subjugated, and the rest through generations of experience, that the way that you will come to interpret your scripture and how you will make it work for you might be different, different in ways that are understandable, defensible, whatever it might be. You know, I'm not putting myself forward here as an expert on black liberation theology. I'm just saying the idea that theologians of African-American background might have tried to extend or revise or in other ways enrich and deepen the interpretive framework that they bring to the scriptures and teach that to their people. The idea that they might respond out of a sense of a need to counteract self-hatred and an internalized sense of secondary status within the society. The idea that they might need to say, you know, God's on our side in the struggle to liberate ourselves and so forth. It's not, you know, this is not such a strange or bizarre notion at all. And, you know, anyway.
We've all got a lot of listening to do for the rest of this campaign, but Glenn, this is hugely interesting as a kind of benchmark. You are a polymath indeed. There's a preacher in there trying to get out too, I think. But thank you enormously.
It's been my pleasure to be with you, Chris.
Wonderful to hear you again on Open Source.